Professor Hastinus. Thank you for giving this interview for the Eurasia Journal of Mathematics, Science and Technology Education. And I'm sure many of our readers will be delighted to read about your ideas and hear about your stories from the past. And I want to begin with your childhood. In what kind of an atmosphere did you have your childhood?
Well, I would say I had quite a fortunate atmosphere because my father was a mathematician and a very good mathematician. He got his PhD from the University of Chicago, and I was born in Chicago. He was ultimately, after going to Harvard for what is a postdoc nowadays, but in those days he had one of a handful of fellowships in the whole United States. And he worked with G.D. Burkhoff in Harvard, and then he came back to Chicago, and I grew up in Chicago, except for periods during World War II when he went to Columbia University to help with the war effort. And my father had a job, was assigned the job of organizing all the mathematicians in the United States for the war effort. So that would be about 1941, mm-hmm. 42, 43. And then he did this at Columbia University, so we moved from Chicago and stayed there for a while.
And what year you were born?
I was born in 1933. Yeah, May 21st, 1933.
May 21st. Mine is May 11th. Okay. Just the same and Salvador Dali. May 11th in okay. My day. Yeah.
And but my father didn't try to teach me mathematics. And it's just that it was an atmosphere, and I saw my father sitting down and working with a piece of paper. In fact, he had amazing powers of concentration. Me and my brother could run around making all sorts of noise, and he would just sit there working away. And later on, I asked him how he got such powers of concentration, because I myself am easily distracted by noise or anything. And he said, well, it's because when he went to college, he had to work in the hallway of the dormitory, and so he had to learn how to concentrate with all the noise of the other dorm students mm-hmm. around.
So can you say he just sort of set a role model for you?
I would say he set a role model, and of all people that I've ever known, I admire him the greatest. He's a very kind and wise man.
Great.
And so he was always giving me wise proverbs as I grew up. For example, whenever I would screw up, he would just shake his head. He wouldn't punish me or anything. He would say, David, you must always check. You know, because usually your screw-ups are because you neglected to do something. And that was one of his...
Okay. Apart from your father, what other things inspired you?
Well,
in terms of, I mean, whatever you want to become.
Actually, I think I was somewhat unusual in being eager for a consistent worldview, even when I was very young. And so although my father had grown up in a religious atmosphere, he was non-practicing. However, for some reason, I felt the need to go to church and Sunday school all by myself without my parents sending me there. And so I was looking, and Christianity became my first worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And that lasted until, well, in high school. I remember my history teacher commenting, how is it that I'm the only one in my class who knows what he's going to be when he grows up? And that was to be a missionary doctor. Well, why a missionary doctor? Well, because there were missionaries in my heritage. I knew about that, ministers and missionaries. And then I was good at science, so I thought I should be a doctor because I had learned the doctrine that you should use the talents God has given you. And so I thought, well, I guess I better have to do that because that's my talent. And it wasn't until... When I got to college, I was pre-med to become a missionary doctor. But then when I got to the zoology classes where I had to memorize all this stuff and everything stunk of formaldehyde, I decided to omit the doctor part. And I changed my major almost every semester while I was in college because I felt very comfortable in college because of the academic atmosphere of my family. And I was the oldest child. So I looked upon college as a place to explore and find out. So I was always taking classes in subjects that was outside my major and so on. I ended up with something like close to a year's worth of extra credits that I took during the usual 4 years. I graduated in 4 years, but I took so many other courses that then I went to pre-seminary and became a speech major. And I liked that, and it was in forensics competition in speech and debate, which was extracurricular, which I think I learned maybe the most important things that I learned in college, and that was how to present an argument in front of skeptical opponents who are looking to find out what the problem is with your argument. And so how do you defend yourself? And I have actually used that in the design of instruction for students because I think it's important to promote scientific argumentation. How do you formulate a claim and defend it with argument and evidence is one of the things that I aim to do.
Argumentation is becoming a more popular topic in terms of science education research these days.
It's not popular enough, actually. they should think more about it. But
yeah,
there has been some good work that hasn't been as recognized as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they could learn a lot from what goes on in debate
yep.
programs
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and forensic. So I was a speech major, but then I started taking some courses in philosophy. I came back to UCLA while my father was chairman of the math department. And in the summers, I took first philosophy courses. And so I went back and I decided that I wanted to major in philosophy. And I became the first major at Pacific Lutheran in philosophy. They had one philosophy professor and he'd never graduated anybody with a degree in philosophy. So I ended up graduating with a degree in speech and philosophy. And it was in the last summer of my last year that I started reading Philosophy of Science. And when I read Philosophy of Science, I read in particular Reichenbach. And I noticed that the philosophers would say, well, Heisenberg says this, and Schrödinger says that, and Bohr says that. And I said, this can't be philosophy that they're doing. They're just quoting the physicist. This must be the revealed word. It must be that the physicists are the real philosophers. So I decided to change my major to physics just as I graduated from college.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took my first semester of freshman physics, my last semester of my senior year at Pacific Lutheran University. Well, that last semester, I got married. I had an overload of 19 units. I was on the golf team. And I did debate as extracurricular activities. And physics was early in the morning. And so I took physics and the first semester of calculus, too, at the same time. Same professor there at that school, because it's a small school. And he barely gave me a passing grade in both. And he had heard that my plan was that I wanted to become a physicist. And he said, as he handed out my grade at the end of the semester, he said, "You'll never be a physicist." Well, it didn't bother me because I knew that my father was a very good mathematician. And I didn't think he was so smart.
Hmm. So how did he become a good mathematician, do you think?
Well, that's a very interesting story. You want to hear the story about how my father became a mathematician?
Sure, please.
Yes, well, I read some years later, when I was in graduate school, I read an article in the journal Daedalus. Have you ever heard of Daedalus? D-A-E-D-A-L-U-S. And it is a wonderful journal of science and the arts, and a very intellectual journal. It's been going on for a long time. So this would be around 1960 that I read this article, and the article was a profile of the typical professor in a United States university. And I read it, and I was amazed because it was almost a perfect description of my father.
Mm.
Because what happened was that he was in a Norwegian community, were of Norwegian descent, in the Midwest, in Minnesota. And in Minnesota, this was the time when he went to school of the migration of students from farms, young people from farms to cities. And they had wonderful universities and schools in Minnesota. The University of Minnesota, University of Wisconsin, and St. Olaf College, which my father went to first.
Which one?
St. Olaf, which is an outstanding liberal arts college. It's probably got the best math program of any liberal small college in the United States. Anyway, so when people like him that came from the farm, they were taking some science classes, and they had two options lifetime. Either they were going to go back on the farm, and the only other thing they knew was to stay at a university. And my father had gone to the farm with the intention of being the best hog farmer in the state of Minnesota. But he kept getting straight A's in mathematics. And then they offered him scholarships and fellowships, and they kept offering all the way till he had a fellowship to go to the University of Chicago and became a student at one of the leading mathematics universities in the United States at the time.
Yep.
And so that's how he got into that field. So he was basically a farmer's boy who became a mathematician. And so I guess he thought that, well, he went and developed his mathematics by himself, and he figured I could figure out what I wanted to do by myself, because he never pressed me to learn any mathematics or physics. I only remember one incident in which he gave me a book on electronics. And he said, "You should take physics."
In about what?
In high school. In high school. And so I took physics, and I couldn't understand why he thought it was something I would like. The author of the physics textbook, his name was Charles E. Dahl. And that's what most of the students thought. It turns out that book was one of the most widely used for 20 or 30 years textbooks in the United States. But it didn't inspire me, among other people, so I just brushed off physics and didn't think about it until my senior year in college, when I started reading Philosophy of Science, because I was looking for a worldview. So So since religion didn't satisfy my worldview, I learned that there were other worldviews. And so I went in to physics for the reason because I wanted to do philosophy, actually. Mm-hmm. Natural philosophy. And I regard my late going into physics. See, that was when I was age 20. I graduated at 20. And then I was already married, and my wife had a daughter, and the Korean War was going on, so I volunteered to be drafted in the Army, and then I ended up getting the GI Bill, which helped support me into graduate school with the GI Bill, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I started studying physics seriously at age 23 when I got out of the Army. And I went I was assigned an advisor who was an experimentalist, and he was appalled at my lack of physics background. That I was accepted, well, because I had good grades, I was accepted in graduate school, but it was only a provisional acceptance because I only had one semester of physics. And so he wanted to show me, he said, well, you can finish your degree you can make up your deficiencies in 4 years. And he showed me how to do that. That's not possible. Fortunately, since my father was chair of the math department at UCLA, which was quite a big school at that time, I went and told him and complained to him. I said, that's ridiculous. I shouldn't have to take 4 years to make this up. And he said, you go talk to Dave Saxon. Now, Dave Saxon, it turns out, he was an associate professor at that time, but he was a very wise man, and he ended up being president of the whole California system, eventually. And so he had all those talents. And one of his talents was that he thought outside the box. And so he went through my program and discussed with me, and he would say, now, these two courses, if you take this course first, you don't have to take the other one because the other one is the prerequisite for this course. And then he said, he was a theoretical physicist, and he said, well, you are going in the graduate program, so you don't have to satisfy the requirements for labs. So you don't have to take any labs. So I didn't take any laboratory courses.
Hmm.
And I ended up, he helped me complete the entire undergraduate curriculum in 1 year. And in the second year after that, I had a master's degree, starting from practically zero.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fairly fast movement. And one thing that I learned from that was that we're too strict in requiring people to fulfill all these requirements in a subject. There were, of course, big holes in my background in physics. And one of the holes came up when I had my PhD oral exams. But that's a separate story. And which I don't know, we don't have to go through. It's just one thing, another thing that I ended up overcoming. But it delayed me another year. But still, I finished fairly rapidly.
Yeah.
And so then I started doing my graduate work. And because of my background in philosophy, I was very much interested in the mathematical languages, the physics, and the history of language, because I had read Bertrand Russell, who talked about the foundations of mathematics, and I knew about his work, which of course other students didn't know, about Principia Mathematica that he wrote with Alfred North Whitehead. And I was convinced that, they wanted to say that mathematics is derivative from logic. That was the proposal, and I wanted to convince my father that he should help me. He should write a calculus textbook with me to prove that. My father was so wise, he didn't say no. He just sort of let me talk about it and think about it. And then, of course, I didn't know how to do it. And it wasn't very long before I decided that that was the wrong way to do everything anyway. So, since he was chair of the math department, he made it possible for me, after I had finished all the basic requirements to do my dissertation, I took a year off from the physics department and got an office in the math department and just studied mathematical languages in MATIC. In particular, I studied quantum electrodynamics and learned about the work of Feynman, and I had one of the very first courses in the United States on differential forms in a differential geometry course taught by a professor named Barrett O'Neill. And one day I went up to the math engineering library and they had a shelf in which incoming new books came in.
And I
pulled down some lecture notes, and it said Clifford numbers and spinners.
What?
Clifford numbers and spinners. Okay? I think that's the title of it. By Marcel Rees. And or maybe it was Clifford algebra and spinners. Anyway, it was about Clifford algebra as a mathematical system. And I read, I think, for about 15 minutes, and all of a sudden I had an epiphany. I said, gee, the Dirac algebra, do you know the Dirac algebra?
I do.
Yeah. Well, you know the Feynman trace calculus.
Not that much.
Well, anyway, it turns out that all the computations in quantum electrodynamics can be used without picking out a matrix representation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what I learned from reading Marcel Rees was that in fact, being a matrix representation was irrelevant. It was the algebraic structure of the Dirac algebra, and I recognized that it included the algebraic structure in differential forms. And so that got me started on the on developing what has become now geometric algebra, which is a very powerful unified mathematical language for physics. And that's been my main work as a physicist, and I've written many books and published many papers, but it got started right then as graduate school. I also had Feynman for quantum electrodynamics during that period, and I remember him saying that every idea that he ever had its beginnings when he was a graduate student.
So you took a course from him?
I took a course from him, but it was not at UCLA. It was at Hughes Research Institute, and I went there with a group of graduate students from UCLA to hear his lectures once a week, two-hour lectures for 2 years. And he did quantum electrodynamics and then some solid-state physics during that time. So, I ended up doing my thesis on this subject, even though my professor, who was my doctoral advisor, didn't really appreciate what I was doing. And I would go in and tell him, and then he would tell me what he wants to do, and I would go and work on what he wants to do for a little while, and I'd come back and I'd say, that doesn't work, and so then I'd go back and do my thing. And this went on for about 2 years until I came in and told him one thing, and I said, well, you think I've got enough for a thesis? And he said, no. And then I went back and I wrote up a 165-page thesis and handed it to him, and I said, do you think I have enough for a thesis? And he said, yes.
And what department he was in?
In physics. In physics. Well, another interesting thing that happened here that no one in the world knows except me, and now you know. And that is that my father had arranged for John von Neumann to be hired as a something like a university professor at UCLA. And, you know, at that time, John von Neumann was the nation's leading mathematician. He's known as the father of the computer. My father ran the Institute of Numerical Analysis, where the first computer on the Western United States was. And that's where I did my study when I first started graduate school, there with all the people in that area. And that was good, too, not because I did so much, but because of the relationships with mathematicians and the very first computer scientists that started, first generation of computer scientists.
And about what year?
That was, I started graduate school in 1956. So I spent 56 through 58 there. And then I spent that year in the math department. And then I went back to the physics department and finished out my thesis. And I included in my thesis some things that I thought my professor liked, but which I didn't like. And then it turns out that 3 months after I finished my thesis, I came across the idea that really made it work beautifully, that has set my view. And that is, since you know Dirac algebra, if you see it as generated by the Dirac matrices, instead of interpreting them matrices, interpret them as vectors.
Mm-hmm.
And so these vectors then generate an algebra, which is a Clifford algebra, mathematically speaking. But it as I developed it, it's an encoding of the geometric properties of space-time in algebraic form. And so if you take that viewpoint, then the Pauli algebra, which has a 2x2 matrix representation, however, in the abstract form, is just a subalgebra of the Dirac algebra.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first thing that I learned about. Oh, yes, yeah, okay.
Can you say?
Earlier than that, I had a story, and this is one of the big highlights of my life, and maybe very helpful in motivation, that is, where keeping me going for developing this thing. Because when I first recognized that the Pauli matrices can be regarded as vectors, and the product of, you have a geometric interpretation then of their products. I went and I gave a little lecture on this to my father. And I said, look at this. There's an identity. A dot sigma times V dot sigma. Do you know that identity with the Pauli algebra? Anyway, it's in lots of quantum mechanics books. And I said, this identity is redundant because it's using vector algebra and matrix algebra, putting them together into one system. But if you change the interpretation to a G so that the sigmas are vectors, then in fact, you just have one algebraic system. And so there's a redundancy in the traditional mathematical system. And there's a geometric reason for the Pauli algebra, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with spin. So I gave him a little lecture on what I had figured out about this. And he gave me the greatest compliment I've had in my life, which I still remember to this day. in which he said, "You have learned the difference between a mathematical idea and its representation. Many mathematicians never learn that." So that made me feel good. Because actually my father was very sparing on his compliments. I had to really do something good to get praised by him. And so that was one of the few cases when I got praised. I knew that that was something good. And so then I did that, and I finished my thesis in this and did something that satisfied my professor, but it didn't satisfy me, so I never published that part. The part that he actually got the thesis for and the part that he just let go on, that was the part that became something important. And I got a postdoc, a two-year National Science Foundation postdoc with John Wheeler at Princeton University. And so I spent 2 years there. And Princeton University was, I came when I went there as a postdoc, I found that it was a kind of a clearinghouse for postdocs. They had postdocs from all over the United States that would come there, and then they would be distributed out to various faculty positions. And I was asked to consider the chair at Arizona State University, which was then a young university, one of the new universities. There were several that were created in the 1960s. It had been a teacher's college, but it was converted to a university in 1958. And the chair was a graduate of Princeton. He had his PhD from Princeton, and so he asked John Wheeler, who have you got that might come out here? Mm-hmm. And so I talked to my father, I said, about this, and he said, this is a very wise man. He said, "Well, that's a very good place to go. And the reason is because it's a new university, it's going to grow rapidly. And if you are in a rapidly growing place, you will be able to write your own ticket on what you do." And that's exactly the way it worked out. Arizona State University has been the most rapidly growing university in the United States in the 40 years since I first went there. And it is now the largest university in the United States, 65,000 students.
Uh-huh.
And so that was one reason why I agreed to accept, because I'd never heard of Arizona State University before. Now it's moving up quite rapidly in the academic world. But my father, the reason he knew this is because he had been on a committee for the National Research Council, I believe, to go around and study the academic accreditation of all the new schools in the United States. And so he had seen all these, and he knew Arizona State was one of the best.
Mm-hmm.
Most promising. And
so
that's how I got there.
So you got the insiders.
Yeah, and another reason that I got there and didn't move is because I told you I was married while I was in college, and I had my first child while I was in the Army, and my second child was born the first day of graduate school, and by the time I finished my PhD, I had four children. And so I went to Princeton.
That's quite a success. I mean, every child is like another dissertation, I can tell you.
Yeah, so I'm not impressed by the problems that people have when they have extra children. But it does have the problem of you don't want to move around to different universities very much, because moving is quite a pain when you have a big family to move around. But all that worked out quite nicely. And so then at Arizona State University, I was able to write my ticket right away because I since I had this training in debate, I knew that you wanted to negotiate, and I negotiated to be able to teach exactly what I wanted. I said, well, if I come there, I want to teach a graduate course. I want to teach only graduate courses. I want to teach graduate course on E&M using geometric algebra, my own mathematical language, because I wanted to develop the language. And I want to teach relativity, which I did. And I also had become very impressed with the maximum entropy approach to statistical mechanics by Edwin T. James. It's one of the great contributors, the information theory approach to statistical mechanics. And I wanted to teach that. In fact, that was my other choice that I, what I was considering was to go where James was, which is at Washington University. But they had such a small department and they're all eminent people there. I didn't get an offer from there. So, otherwise, I would have gone there because he was one of the physicists in the next generation ahead of me that I most admired and still admire. He's now passed away, but I got for the next 8 years to teach only graduate courses in the subject, and that helped me develop my materials. So now geometric algebra has continued to develop. I've written several books and published widely, and it has become a recognized discipline. There are now, in the last several years, there's been one or two books published by other people in the same subject. It's becoming, there's a book on its use in computer science. There is a book by two professors at Cambridge University, which is called Geometric Algebra for Physicists, and it's all the stuff that I've developed because a group there took it over, and that helped a lot because I didn't have any colleagues at Arizona State University to help me with this. They were too traditional, and it's now being used in robotics, and it's clearly, there are conferences in geometric algebra every year around the world, in which I usually go to them. In fact, I think I've gone to every one of them because I'm always invited, and I feel some obligation to do it. But the whole system is going to keep growing without me. My objective was to make this a standard unified language for physics because it is arguably the optimal mathematical language for physics. For example, you can do introductory physics using geometric algebra without using any coordinates. But that's a whole lecture. Actually, I gave a lecture on that when I was given the Oersted Medal for my contributions to physics education. My Oersted Medal paper, which is published in the American Journal of Physics, is an introduction to geometric algebra at an elementary level. And I'm willing to bet that it is going to become the standard language even in high school, for high school, because it enables you to formulate high school algebra, geometry, and trigonometry in one coherent system that also is applicable to physics. So it puts it all together in a remarkable way.
So is it easy to make sense for...
Well, you see, if you've already learned a different language, right?
Mm-hmm.
A new language looks hard.
Yes.
No matter what language, okay? And however, if you analyze the language in terms of its structure, it can't be harder. It's because the assumptions are simpler, the geometric interpretation of the algebraic operations is more direct and it's richer than ordinary vector algebra. That it includes all the features of ordinary vector algebra, but it's not limited to three dimensions, and it works in space-time, and so you have a vector algebra of space-time, which it turns out is the Dirac algebra. But now, there's an amazing thing about this algebra, and that is that one of the things I discovered is when I reformulate the Dirac theory in terms of geometric algebra, where all the gammas, the gamma mu's, the matrices, gamma matrices, they are now vectors. Okay, so the four gamma mu's is a frame, an orthonormal frame of four vectors in space-time. But what about the imaginary unit, I, in quantum mechanics? Well, it turns out that you don't need it.
You don't need it?
You don't need it. That's all you need. Because among these four vectors, there is one time-like vector and three space-like vectors, right? If you have a frame of four vectors, if you take the product of two space-like vectors, that is the generator of rotations in a plane, and its square is minus one. And it turns out, and I proved this in 1967 in a published paper in Journal of Mathematical Physics, that that is necessarily the generator of the phase in the wave function. It actually has a geometric algebra, and what's the meaning of it being a generator in a plane? Well, that plane is the plane that determines the direction of the spin. So spin and complex numbers are intimately, inseparably related in the Dirac equation. You cannot see it in the ordinary matrix formulation because the geometry is suppressed, because matrix algebra is not a geometric algebra. It was developed in a purely formal way from studying systems of linear equations, really. And then I learned and developed that you can not only change geometric algebra and give them matrix representations, but you can take matrices and give them geometric algebra representations. But the geometric algebra has a direct geometric meaning. So there is a meaning to the generator of the I that occurs. Now, I also proved, I suspected it, but it took me a while to prove, that when you do the non-relativistic approximation to the Dirac equation, you go to the Pauli equation, and then you go to the Schrödinger equation. Now, they usually say that the Schrödinger equation it describes a particle without spin. But it turns out when you do the approximation methods, this I, which is the generator of rotations in a plane, becomes the I in the Schrödinger equation. So the I in the Schrödinger equation has the generator of rotations in a plane. And that plane is determined by its normal, is a spin direction, and the Schrödinger equation is not describing a particle with no spin, it's describing a particle in an eigenstate of spin.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has been a major theme of my research. What does that mean, and what is implications? And I am working on that to this day, and I have a published paper coming out on it, which has been under development for some time. But I already have one version of it in the archives, the physics archives. But I'm going to put I've just made another improvement in it, which I think is now the final improvement for it. It's going to be in the archives, and then I think it will be published in Foundations of Physics.
Great.
Yeah. So that keeps going, and I've been doing all of that stuff.
And you're still excited after 40 years.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And as a matter of fact, well, if you're interested, I can tell you a little bit about the mathematical, what it's all led to.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of Zitter-Bewegung? C-I-T-T-E-R-B-E-W-U-N-G.
I'm not familiar.
That's German word. It means trembling motion. And it was the term was coined by Schrödinger. When Dirac originally published his paper, he noticed that if you try to make a wave packet with the free particle solutions of the Dirac equation, something funny happens. You can't make a wave packet using only the positive energy. See, Dirac equation first had the trouble that there were positive and negative energy solutions. And everybody believes that for a free particle, the energy has to be positive. And, well, you have to have both positive and negative energy solutions in a wave packet, otherwise you don't have a complete set. And there's oscillations between these things and in the free particle solution. So you make a wave packet and it has these oscillations, and he called that zero wave. And the frequency of the oscillations is twice the De Broglie frequency. You know the De Broglie frequency, mc squared over h bar. The zero Bethe frequency is twice that. Okay? So he published this paper almost immediately after Dirac made his published equation. And he suggested that this oscillation actually was a circulation of charge, and that was generated the magnetic moment of the electron. And Dirac assented to that, agreed to that, talked about it, put it in his book. You can find it in his famous book on quantum mechanics. And it still pops up in books on quantum electrodynamics to this day, but nobody has ever made any use of it except as a convenient metaphor. The question then that I asked is, well, is it more than a metaphor, or is the Zitterbewegung a window to a substructure in quantum mechanics which is associated with these oscillations? And after actually decades of trying, I finally have a model which is a particle model of the electron, in which is a lifelike electron. It moves with the speed of light, but it moves in a helix in space-time. And the diameter of the helix is a Compton wavelength. The Zitterbewegung is this oscillation, and it generates the magnetic moment of the electron. So the magnetic moment is just the average part of a highly fluctuating electromagnetic field. And I have completely well-defined differential equations. They are surprisingly difficult to find what those equations should be, but now they're in quite a simple form. And I'm quite happy with them. And I have a prediction that you can detect this Zitterbewegung directly, because this oscillation, if you do a multipole expansion of the circulation of charge, then you get a rotating dipole moment. You get an average magnetic moment, which everybody knows the electron. But this rotating dipole is rotating with the Zitterbewegung frequency, which is 10 to the 21st hertz. Okay? That's too high for anybody to see, except in a resonance. And so it turns out that there is a resonance experiment that had already been done, which I can tell you about. You want to hear about the resonance experiment?
Please.
Yeah. Okay. So this is science in the making. Maybe there was a. If we go back to De Broglie, he's credited with proposing wave-particle duality. But that wasn't where he started. His original idea was that the electron has an internal oscillation. And so it's got an internal clock. And this internal clock is attached to a wave that oscillates with the same frequency. And then Schrödinger took De Broglie's idea and made his equation. He forgot all about the clock part and just had wave-particle duality. Everybody else forgot about it, pretty much, except a few Frenchmen. And there was one French experimentalist who didn't know about any quantum, didn't know quantum electrodynamics, although he did high energy experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And so he decided, gee, I should look for that clock. I'm an experimentalist. If there is a clock, it should appear. Well, it's got a very high frequency, but can't we find some resonance? So he cast around to see if there was a situation, and he discovered that there is a possible way that you can create a resonance interaction. And that is in the field of electron channeling. Do you know what that is?
No, I didn't.
Okay. What that is if you steer a beam of electrons at a crystal, you can focus the electrons so that they're aiming right along a crystal axis. And then they get trapped in a spiral that spirals around the crystal axis. And you have a great increase in transmission through the crystal because the scattering is minimized by going through there. And it turns out that you can make the beams so that something like 60% of the electrons of the beam just go down around, spiraling around this one crystal axis. It's amazing how well they can tune this. Okay, so the idea, well, then you can tune the speed at which it goes down and the frequency at which it passes the atomic centers on the crystal axis. And you can tune that frequency to the de Broglie frequency. And so this guy realized that, and he said, well, if there really is a clock, then you have a resonance situation, and he had no idea about an resonant interaction. He said, there should be an interaction there if there is a clock. But nobody would support doing such a crazy experiment. So he wrote a proposal to do a more conventional experiment on crystal channeling. And after he had assembled the team to do their experiment, then he told them the real reason why he made this proposal. It was really to do this experiment. So they used all the money, which was on an accelerator at Saclay, because they're expensive, you know, to use the accelerators. They did the job that they were paid for, and then they took one day off to do his experiment. And he got a positive result. He got a resonance. Okay, so he took a long time to write it up, mainly because he had to sharpen up the data analysis and things like that. But he couldn't get it published anyplace, so he published it in an obscure journal called the Annals of the de Broglie Institute, and which nobody reads. And then after a couple of years, he decided that he actually believed their result, which is not predicted by any quantum mechanics or the Dirac equation. A lot of work on channeling experiments. Nobody had even thought of the possibility. And I'm convinced that you can't get it out of the standard quantum mechanics. It doesn't have what you need to do it. And so he rewrote it and sent a letter to Physical Review. And he got, they had something like 5 reviewers. And the typical kind of review amounted to saying, well, there's no theoretical reason why this should exist, so it can't be right.
Hmm.
Okay? That reminds me of Eddington's remark, that I won't believe the experiment until it is confirmed by theory.
So theory precedes experiment.
Well, you don't want to do anything that contradicts quantum mechanics, do you?
No,
that couldn't be right.
I mean,
Bohr said quantum mechanics has a complete description of nature. Of course, he only used the Dirac equation. He didn't use the Dirac equation. He said Schrödinger equation. But the Dirac equation shows that the Schrödinger equation isn't complete. Well, is the Dirac equation not complete? Okay, so anyway, so it was rejected. But one of the reviewers said, maybe this effect that you're talking about is an effect of Sirabhavegam. He's never heard of Sirabhavegam, because that's only in theoretical textbooks. So he Googled it on the web, and he found a paper on the Sirabhavegam interpretation of quantum mechanics by a guy named David Hestinus. And so he contacted me and told me about it, and I was writing this paper. Well, I had already written a major version of it, so I thought, well, okay, so I was looking for what are their experimental tests. There are many others of the model that I told you, this, which I call the Zitter model. Zitter-Bewegung is too much of a mouthful to say all the time. So I call this phenomena of the helical motion of the electron Zitter. And so then I wrote a letter which I worked out. And it, you see, the first of all is he found the resonance at the de Broglie frequency, which is half the Zitter frequency. So you'd think, well, that can't be right. How can they be the same? Well, I actually did the calculation, and it turns out that there's a mathematical reason why it comes out, and it describes it perfectly. So I used my model, and I've analyzed it, and I not only account for that factor of two, but I account for the error. It turns out that the actual measured frequency was a little bit off. So there was a shift of the resonance. See, what he did was search for the resonance over a frequency range. And the point that he found it was a little bit off from the predicted de Broglie frequency. But I was able to explain that. It's actually as a splitting. There's a splitting, and it's a resonance that isn't resolved. And so, now that's waiting, and that was rejected for publication in Physical Review, not Physical Review Letters, because my paper was just one page too long to be submitted to that. But it was submitted to another journal. And the editor said that he tried seven theoretical physicists, but none of them were interested enough to read it. And he said, so maybe you should try doing something else with it. So it was never read. And however, there is one famous physicist who did read it and wrote a letter of support for redoing the experiment, and right now we're waiting to have the experiment redone, and it looks like it's online to be done in maybe the next year in an Italian with an Italian experiment. So we shall see.
Good luck
about that. Yeah. And so that's the scientific work that I've been working on most recently, but the geometric algebra also works in general relativity and gravity and black holes and things like that as well. Most of the work in that direction has been done by the group of Cambridge that has adopted it and used it very beautifully.
I never knew about this kind of work that you have done because I know you mostly from your physics education.
Yeah,
research.
Except only my Oersted lecture.
Yeah.
Okay, so I gave my Oersted lecture on a different subject than what they. But I related it to science education, because what you are able to understand about science depends on your conceptual tools, your representational tools, your mathematical tools. If you had to do all your calculations in Roman numerals, you wouldn't do very well. Okay? So the whole history of mathematics has been learning how to improve the mathematical language. Well, it's not done developing, and my argument is geometric algebra is the next phase in the development, and I have an advanced book on mechanics that's all done in geometric algebra, all done in completely coordinate free, including rotational dynamics, tops, and all of that stuff. No matrices. And it's got an introductory chapter, which is a chapter of the history, a kind of semi-history of geometric algebra. Well, so I think geometric algebra may, I believe it will eventually become standard language in physics and probably much more widely, equally useful in engineering. Then on the other hand, I did
tremendous
education and research.
Yeah. And how did you get involved in education and research? What were the reasons?
Well,
in the first place, because as I can see, you were way too busy with other scientific work.
When you have four kids, they have trouble with science, you wonder about what the problem was, and then you see students having it. Well, the same, where it really got started was in 1976. I was a full professor by that time. And I had finished my decade of being able to teach all graduate courses. And so I started to take my turn teaching the introductory physics courses. And then I talked to a colleague who was actually the chair that hired me in the first place. And he was one of the most dedicated teachers I've ever known.
And his name?
His name was Richard Stoner. And Richard Stoner was so excited that he had an office right near mine, and he would regale me. He would show me all his examinations that he gave and talk about it, because he believed that there was much too much quantitative problem solving for the students, and that you should give questions in which they have to use qualitative arguments. And he could not write an examination in which the class average was better than 40%. So he'd come in and he would talk about these things. And I got very curious. I thought there must be something there. Now, because of my background in philosophy, and because of my, I actually was right there where my father is one of the developers of the field of numerical analysis. And so I followed the development in artificial intelligence in my spare time from its beginning.
With four kids and physics, you still had some spare time.
So I was very much interested in this. And then Robert Karplus, you know about Karplus? Well, he was he gave some famous workshops for the AAPT. Do you know about those workshops?
No, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, they were brilliant workshops that involved, he had the professors go in and gave them tasks to do under conditions which simulated the conditions of students. For example, trying to solve problems looking at a mirror that inverted the images, and they couldn't coordinate their hands in order to be able to do these things and devices like that. So he was very deeply involved with Piaget and developed a curriculum for introductory students. And you know that not long after that, I think it was about 78, he had a terrible stroke and was disabled. So otherwise, the history of science education might be much different. He was one of the big motivators. And so I went to his workshop, and that got me interested in Piaget. And so then I started devouring and read Piaget. And I was always thinking about these problems that Richard Stoner had with these teachers, with the students. Why are they having these problems? And, well, there were a couple other incidents, which I won't bother to tell you about, which got me to the clue that they had alternative conceptions about what's going on. And then the new chair in 1980. So I started a graduate seminar to talk and read some of the literature and talk about it with graduate students about the problems of physics education. This was 1979 that I started that. And I published my first paper on physics education in 1979, which was a review of Piaget and the relevance of psychology. It was called Wherefore, a Science of Teaching.
I read that paper.
Oh, you read that paper. Okay. Well, I'm pleased to report that two people that have gone into science education research told me about 15 years later that that was the thing that got them doing it.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I had done this literature review and was reading in psychology and because I'd written this paper and started this seminar, I also had agreed with the editor, Cliff Schwartz, the editor of the Physics Teachers. Do you know him?
No.
Well, anyway, he's the guy that essentially created the Physics Teacher, and he was the editor for a long time until he retired not too long ago, maybe 10 years ago, but he was the editor at that time. And so now that paper was the fastest published paper I ever had. I sent it in, and in 1 week I got back the page proofs. That was before it was accepted I had the page proofs. And then it was adopted by the director of the National Science Foundation, the science education part has required reading for all of the people in the directorate. And so then he invited me to be a reviewers for proposals. This was 1979.
Yeah, that was a long time ago. I read that paper. It was talking about how the computers work and like the.
It talked about our artificial intelligence,
yeah.
Models of
human thinking.
Of human thinking, yes,
yeah.
Which are all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, so it was first generation cognitive science, which
mm-hmm.
is based on the brain as a model of a computer.
Yes.
So the computer...
Long-term memory, short-term memory...
Exactly,
stuff.
That's right. That's
I remember
right.
that.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and so all that's valuable, but is completely changed by developments in neural network theory, for which I was, in 1983, I was one of the people that organized the very first conference on neural network modeling for the brain. And so I spent a decade doing that stuff too, and published a few papers in that.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had to stop doing that because I had doing too many things. And I didn't have any really good colleagues at my university doing that kind of work.
You also developed with your colleagues, the first concept inventor and mechanical scientist.
Well, that's
and the modeling.
Okay, I was going to
theory.
Tell you. So I published these papers, all right, and went to the NSF. I published that paper, and so the department chair had a graduate student. A guy who applied for graduate school and was coming with all his own money to pay his way. And he was sent from Lebanon. And his name was
Ibrahim
Halil.
Yeah.
Okay? So he accepted him and then told me that I have a PhD student. You know? I didn't decide that I was going to do PhD research. So we started that. And then at the same time, there was a outstanding teacher named Malcolm Wells who came to me and said, and he had taken every course in the university that was relevant to teaching. He had studied Piaget, and he'd taken all the education courses, and he said he wanted to write a dissertation that actually did something.
We have a saying in Turkish, the lead and the pot matches. they just roll around and just got...
Yeah, these two guys came at the same time. These two guys
and find you all of a sudden.
And also at the same time, I was now assigned to teach introductory physics. And I was already convinced from my philosophy work and from my scientific work that models is central. And so I started teaching the introductory physics course as a modeling approach. And I formulated the principles of modeling theory. And these guys came along, and Haloon took that, and then I told him about the ideas of why these students were having so much trouble, and we got the theme on starting to develop a systematic instrument for assessing for discriminating between the students' ideas and the physics ideas, because the FCI is essentially a discrimination test. It's asking the students to be able to discriminate between a scientific statement and a non-scientific one. And of course, the non-scientific ones, these distractors on the multiple choice test, have been chosen from research to correspond to things that most people believe. And so, if you don't know science, the distractors look very much more attractive. And so Haloon then, as his dissertation started working, he did all the grunt work of putting the test together and testing it out on the populations. And we published our first paper that had the most spectacular results that established everything. Did you read that paper?
It
on the science
guide. I've read almost every paper of yours in education.
So this paper, had the results on the mechanics diagnostic, which is about. It has about the same questions. About 50% of the questions on the force concept inventory are the same as on this mechanics diagnostic. And it had these amazing results. We had four professors and some 2,000 students of these four professors. And each professor had a different style of teaching. Two of them had awards for being outstanding teachers.
Can we put a parenthesis there? How do you think physics people learn to teach? I mean, physics professors. And you just said they had their own ways of teaching. I mean,
I think they just model their teaching from the teaching they've had. Okay?
They teach the way they were taught?
They teach the way that they were taught, which is the lecture method.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But the question is, what about the student's prior knowledge? How does that influence what goes on in the classroom? And so they hadn't studied that. And so this was the first systematic study of it. There were individual studies, which are all referenced in one of our papers, that had noticed various clues about alternative conceptions, which are dismissed as misconceptions by the professors, except they don't know that some of these misconceptions were held by Newton and Galileo, and of course they know that some of them were held by Aristotle, but of course he didn't know anything. So in fact, these alternative conceptions are very reasonable hypotheses for the way the world works. The trouble is, they hadn't been subjected to scrutiny. And when the students take the introductory physics course, they're not scrutinized. And the students interpret what is said, what they say, what they hear and do, in terms of these alternative conceptions. And it works for some problems, and it doesn't work for others. So sometimes you get some things right. So that starts to account for why the grades... You see, the professors had been giving these partial credit for doing problems all the time, thinking that these are random mistakes. But they aren't random mistakes. They are systematic errors. Systematic, they're basically because they misunderstand what are the concepts that are involved.
From the beginning.
From the beginning, and this is and the instruction is not designed to address that fact. Okay, so we got this first dramatic evidence for this from these four professors, all teaching in a different style. Two of them with awards for teaching. One was a problem-solving drill instructor. He believed you practice problem-solving, and he did that in his lectures. He had the students working and did it, and then you go home and do it, and so on. And then another guy was an experimentalist. He believes what you have to do is you develop the student's intuition. And you do the intuition by giving them demonstrations, because seeing is believing, okay? And then another guy was a theoretician who thought that, well, you have to understand the logical structure of the subject. And so you can't understand conservation of energy without deriving the work energy theorem from Newton's laws and things like that. And then the fourth guy was a new teacher, and he just followed the book. Okay? And then so we gave a pretest with this thing and showed that students had appallingly low scores, even though almost all of them had high school physics. And then we had the post-test, and there was only a 15% improvement. They were only up to 60%. Whereas you look at the questions, it looks like they're so trivial you shouldn't even have to ask them. But it's a 60% score for them. And furthermore, all professors, the scores for their classes were within 1% of them. So it didn't matter whether they were outstanding, which technique they used, or whatever. I'm happy to say that I was one of those professors. Okay, so this had a couple of... the paper went over very well. It had immediate impact. There was an AAPT meeting shortly after that in which I had submitted the paper, and I gave a talk on the results of the paper. And the editor of the paper came running down from the audience after the talk. He says, "Was that what your paper was about?" And then he accelerated the publication of it. And now Malcolm Wells, my high school teacher, who was the most dedicated and experienced high school teacher who had tried everything, he looked at the results of this and he says, "My students can do better than that." So he gave it to his students, and they didn't do better. Okay? So that was a clue that Malcolm Wells, he just hit upon that. He just couldn't take that. His students had to be better than the physics students that were taught at the university. And it's true that he was a better teacher, actually. So we had been arguing for 2 years about what would be the real contribution, and then he saw this, and he saw, okay, well, we have to be able to show that you can get better results than these results. And so that's when he started on his dissertation, and that was about the time Holun was finishing off his dissertation using mainly those results, which I wrote up. And it was only after we had done this that I made the taxonomy. A key thing about this is the taxonomy, the classification, to show that it's a complete covering of the Newtonian concept, which I analyzed the Newtonian concept. It's a concept with eight dimensions. The concept of force is, some people say, what is force? Well, force is defined by F equals ma. But no, it takes all five of Newton's laws to define the concept of force. Why do I say five? Don't they usually say three?
Well, that's what I was thinking now.
Yeah, that's right. That's because Newton didn't articulate all of his laws. Okay? And for example, one of the laws that's essential is that space has to be Euclidean. All right? You have to have geometry, and you have to have a clock. You have to have a definition of time.
And a zero flow.
and how did Newton handle that? He handled it in one sentence in his Principia. He said, "I presume you all know geometry."
Hmm.
Okay?
And
that's the zeroth law. That's what I call the zeroth law.
Yeah.
So I wrote a paper called
zeroth law of Pacquet.
You read the paper called Modeling Games of the Newtonian Laws.
I did.
Yeah, and that's my favorite paper on this, and that's where I analyze. But that was written some years after. I did the analysis 10 years before that, which was, and that original. So after the mechanics diagnostic was completed and we had the results, then I developed the taxonomy, because it was only then that I saw what should be actually done. And so we have, the force concept is been regarded as a five-dimensional concept. And you don't understand the concept of force until you have all five dimensions. It's like the engine I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's necessary for educational reform. It doesn't do reform unless all the parts are working. And that's the same way with doing Newtonian mechanics, unless you know all five parts of this. But some of them aren't even recognized, and many physicists and many physics textbooks don't recognize what is the function of Newton's first law. It's not it says that a particle moves at constant speed when there is no net force on the particle. Well, that looks like a special case of the second law, except you have to have what defines constant speed. How do you know when speed is constant? Well, you know when you've got a free particle.
Mm-hmm.
Because when a free particle, by definition, being a free particle, no forces, then it's moving at constant speed. And so then you can use that as a clock. So actually, the function of the first law is to define clocks implicitly in Newtonian mechanics. And so that's not generally right. And at the same time, there are more people that recognize that it's also defining what is inertial reference frame. Okay, which is defined by having free particles. Do you know if you have an inertial reference frame, or you just send off a free particle and see whether it moves in a straight line?
Or not.
And then, I was very happy when I came across that formulation. And I did it when I was writing my mechanics book, which came out right about the same time. This, which is over 600 pages long, which is completely redone the mechanics using geometric algebra. And there you find it all from a modeling point of view, so that you can see how I was thinking about modeling for structuring the whole of Newtonian mechanics in that way. And that was background before I wrote the other paper about modeling games in the Newtonian world. So all these things fit together. So I've done a lot of things, but they all fit together in one coherent program. The modeling program is part of, there are modeling tools, developing modeling tools, and then how do you use these tools? All these things have to do with how does human cognition develop? Developed by the creation of languages, which are generally informally developed. And in mathematics, they're more formally developed. And each language develops its own systematic tools for the language. So, anyway, then I was hooked, because now I had two graduate students that I had to support. And then Malcolm Wells continued his thesis, and he got a spectacular result. He was able to design an experiment. He had learned to use the learning cycle, which was so-called by Robert Karpus, built into his original program, which has three phases that he called exploration, invention, and discover. And Wells was trying to do that. But then I asked him, how do you explore? How do you invent? And how do you discover? Now, that was essentially discovery learning, okay? The exploration, you acquaint the student with the phenomena that you want them to understand, and then they play around with it to sort of try and see its property, and then finally they discover or invent. Some people change it to invention. A way to characterize the patterns that they have learned in the phenomena. But since I was so involved in modeling, I said, no, the way that should be doing is that, and you heard my talk, those stages, okay? That the way you do scientific inquiry systematically is you know that to understand what's going on is to have a model for it. So you have to identify the system that is involved. What are the variables that you're going to use? And these are all free choices that you have to make. And then you can make a model, and then you can test the model, and you can do all that. So I had that clearly in mind at that time. And Malcolm Wells took that and implemented it in his... So there were two ingredients that went into his thesis. He already had inquiry, but now it was inquiry with modeling discourse. Modeling... Mm-hmm. And the other one was being sensitive to the misconceptions that students have and making sure that they have the opportunities to, he learned how to draw them out, to negotiate an understanding of these alternative ideas. And so that's how he did the first, well, Haloon also did modeling instruction too. But it was more having to do with problem solving in my test, and we published a paper on that too, and that worked fairly well, but it's not as deep an innovation as what Malcolm Wells did. And anyway, so Malcolm Wells had another high school teacher that was perfectly matched with him. He had been teaching for years and years, and he was teaching problem solving, problem, 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 for the whole year. Malcolm Wells didn't teach any problem solving.
Schwackhammer?
No. It wasn't Schwackhammer. It was a much older guy than Schwackhammer. Schwackhammer came about 5 years later. I'll tell you where he came in. That was after Malcolm did his thesis. And this other guy, can't quite think of the teachers. Anyway, it was perfectly matched. He did problem solving, and so we developed another test called the mechanics baseline test, which was a problem solving test, and we aimed to have it. To do a problem-solving test in which it's non-routine, you have to think about how to do it, and furthermore, that all the questions are so basic that nobody that teaches a physics course should say, we don't cover that material,
mm-hmm.
Okay? So it's the next step of difficulty up from the force concept inventory. Force concept inventory is just a discrimination test. This one requires doing some reasoning and problem with it. Okay, so these were originally developed in order to, Malcolm Wells started working on revising taking what I had done with the mechanics diagnostic that was Haloon had done, revising this to have instruments that would give the best tests for the success of his instruction. So he did this, and a remarkable result came. We had a problem-solving test, and so this match teacher, equally dedicated and experienced and so on, who was teaching the problem-solving, his students did 20% less than Malcolm's. And Malcolm didn't even teach problem solving to speak of. Of course, it was enhanced, it's implicit in what you're doing. So, in other words, he was really teaching them to understand what's going on in the problem. And then that makes solving the problem a lot easier if you understand what's going on. And so I was very impressed with the results. And this teacher, who was about to retire, was so impressed he put off his retirement. He said to Malcolm, "How did you do that?" You know? And so later on when we started workshops, he came to the workshops and then he kept on going 5 years past his retirement age.
Larry?
No.
Because I attended one of those workshops.
No. That's later. Larry came in later. Okay, so then what happened was that, well, I decided since this seems to be showing something that we should, I had been invited to go to the NSF, so I talked with the program manager at the National Science Foundation, and he said, "Well, why don't you put in a pilot project to see whether or not this will work for other teachers besides Malcolm?" So I got a small grant for our first workshops for teachers, which Malcolm and I did together. And that was when I decided that it was better just to let Malcolm do it and not involve me. So I moved out of the room, and Larry attended that first workshop. Swackhammer had, who was a teacher off in Chicago, but he had read my work on modeling. He read the Wherefore teaching and stuff, and he asked to come to visit me for a sabbatical leave, and I said, "You're coming for sabbatical here. Spend your times in Malcolm Wells' classroom." So that was his contribution, as he was in private. He sort of looked at the test, but the test was mainly developed by me and Malcolm. And of course, Haloon had a big contribution. So the three of us had about equal contribution to it. Although my main contribution was the structuring and the ordering of the concepts and the distinction. And that's when things got going. Our first workshop was the teachers were tremendously enthusiastic about everything. We gave the force concept inventory. There was no gain. Okay? And then we asked, well, how could that be? The teachers thought there was a gain. Something was going. Why wasn't there any gain? If you were doing an ordinary education experiment without this instrument to evaluate what the students actually learned, you would have thought there was a tremendous success. All the teachers thought, no gain. Well, actually, there was something 5% maybe, but that was negligible.
It's
much smaller than a standard deviation, so that makes it insignificant. And then we realized that while we were teaching this, we were also introducing them to the use of MDL, microcomputer-based laboratory tools, probes, and so on, instrumentation, and so on. And the teachers were so focused on the mechanics of how to run the classroom and do everything that they neglected to realize the role of the modeling, of the discourse to draw out the students to correct their misconceptions. So then the second year, we did it again and made sure that the teachers understood that that was crucial to the success of the whole thing. And so that's an example of, you see, of inquiry is not enough. It's how you do the inquiry that is crucial. So we have two major ingredients. The first one is doing it systematically, and modeling gives us a guide as to how to do inquiry systematically. And then the misconceptions research enables you to help identify difficulties and problems in the teacher's assimilating. And then we were off and running. We started workshops, and the FCI got published, and Eric Mazur took it over. We got big grants, and it grew to a nationwide program. So that now there are more than 2,000 teachers out of 23,000 in the United States, all the physics teachers. It's getting close to 10% of all the teachers have taken a modeling workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, of course, there are many details. I mean, there's another 15 years of work going on there. But all the main ingredients were going by then. And then my physics education research from then on has been what you would call something informal, is that I just watched what was going on with the teachers, and then I made recommendations for improvement. I have some very nice improvements, but they haven't been adopted by all the teachers because they haven't worked it fully into the curriculum. And our funding ran out. And so now for several years, we have been trying to get reliable funding, because now that we had this great program, as you heard in my talk, we got this great program, a graduate program, that the teachers can't afford to attend. And so it's financing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much, without going into details of everything, and as Malcolm Wells says, the devil is in the details. How you do modeling, it turns out that to really understand how to teach inquiry with a modeling approach requires, we have established with 10 years of workshops, that the optimal amount of time is 4 weeks. 5 weeks is more than you need. 3 weeks, you barely are able to make it. Okay?
And how many hours in a week?
They are 5 hours a day for 3 weeks.
Mm.
Okay? And that adds up to the number of hours that are required for a three-credit course. So they are three-credit courses at the university. Actually, it's more than 5 hours a day, because it works best when the teachers are all living together, and then they talk about it, and they spend all day doing it, really. So and it's immersion, and that's so there are very important social components to the success of the modeling program. It isn't just all the pedagogy, and it isn't all the curriculum. And in my view, it needs a lot more work, but needs funding, and it needs a new generation of people to do it, because I really would prefer to spend my time doing Zurbevegung, because that's beginning to look very exciting, and there are several things, like, can you explain quantum mechanics? Why do you have quantized states? Well, it turns out that the Zurbevegung solutions, I've only done the constant field case. If you have a constant magnetic field, put an electron in a constant magnetic field. You know there are Landau levels that you get from solving the Schrödinger equation. It's a discrete set of, and it's equivalent. It's essentially a 2D harmonic oscillator because it's uniform circular motion. Well, it turns out that in the Zurbevegung solution, the electron is moving around a guiding center. Okay? So it's got an internal motion. And this internal motion is resonant with the orbital motion of the guiding center, and that's what the quantization is. And it's only the shift in the Zitter motion that is coordinated with this thing. And so I've shown that that these solutions may well be explained. And in fact, Schrödinger, when he originally got his equation, he was looking to describe stationary atomic states as resonances. But he didn't know what resonates with what. So So I had long known that this geometric interpretation of the eye suggests a spatial, internal spatial motion of the electron. So now I've only proved, now in one case, that I can account for the stability of radiation in the state by a resonance. Of course, I haven't proved that that's why it's radiationless. That's the next thing I want to do this summer. And I think I know how to do it.
Good luck to you with that, too. I've studied superconductivity in my master's.
Okay.
And I'm really curious to know your answer to that. Do you think we know all there is to know about the electron?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no.
I mean, because it just occurs to me that we need somewhat new theory of electron, probably, to solve the question of superconductivity. And do you feel a need of that sort for your
work? Well,
your own
work? I feel more than a need. I think I know at least one way that it should be changed.
Hmm.
Okay. Superconductivity doesn't work as well as people make it out to be. When you get near the critical point, they have a renormalization theory that they use to explain it. And the renormalization theory, it's admitted that it doesn't get quite the correct result for the critical point. Okay? And it's not just at the critical point. The deviations of the theory from experimental data increase as you get closer and closer to the critical point. So what's going on there? Here's my hypothesis, and that is that the electrons have this internal zero motion, okay? And when you are getting close to the critical point, you are getting the electrons so that their zero motion is correlated in individual atoms, or independent electrons, okay? I mean, they're in a background of positive atoms.
Is there a coupling again going on there?
Well, because the force between the electron, between two electrons, is not just a magnetic moment. It's a magnetic moment plus a rotating dipole moment.
Hmm.
Okay? Now, if the rotating dipole moments are not coherent, not resonant, then their average force is zero. But as you go to low temperatures, the possibility of getting them correlated so that there's resonance, so they start going around together.
Hmm.
That changes the strength of the interaction. And thermal fluctuations can destroy the interactions, but the thermal fluctuations become less and less significant the lower you go down. And so you can get longer and longer range correlations. And I think that the electron correlations are longer and longer. And furthermore, I think that then they set up stationary patterns, the electrons. You can think of them as chains of electrons, which are coherently. They're various coherence lengths, and they're chains, and the chains get longer and longer as you go down. And I think that's also happening in Bose-Einstein condensation, because Bose-Einstein condensation is really condensation of fermions, because the bosons all have fermion structure. And I think what's going on in the fermion structure is that there is coherence among all the electrons that are hidden in there. Anyway, so that's part of the research project.
That's a hunch.
Well,
it's more than a hunch
because I have well-defined equations of motion for the electron.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a hunch that can be investigated.
Yep.
Yep.
So we call it a hypothesis.
Yeah. So we call it a hypothesis. Right. Well, I mean, that's a good definition. A hunch that can be investigated. A testable hunch.
A testable hunch.
Yeah.
My last question is about you have done so much with education in physics education, and do you think in the future generation of researchers?
Yeah.
What do you suggest to them?
in what ways to proceed and what is left to inquire in physics education research?
Well, I just published a couple of papers in which I have a modeling theory of cognition. And so they say a lot more about what I think physics education researchers should be reading. And they should be reading the literature in cognitive linguistics. And I have a lot
of... What people?
There is a field called cognitive linguistics. You remember George Lakoff. Have you heard of George Lakoff?
Nope.
Well, you should hear about him because he's famous, actually. But my latest paper, I say quite a lot about, actually all of this, in a paper that's called Notes on a Modeling Theory of Instruction. And it was at the Jurep proceedings 2 years ago.
In Amsterdam?
In Amsterdam. That was my paper for my invited talk there. And there is a copy of it on our modeling website where it can be. But then I have another more recent paper, which is a follow-up on this. And so there is more and more understanding of cognitive science. Cognitive science will develop, and we will have a stronger and more coherent theory because they've learned a lot in cognitive linguistics. And by studying what they have learned and correlating what we've done in physics education, I think there's very much to be learned. They have learned that the concept of force, for example, is the source of many metaphors in everyday life and so on. I've already mentioned that it doesn't correspond to the Newtonian concept of force. And I might write something about this in the future. It depends. There's an issue of time.
I think
it's time for these various things. So I think that is a field, and I see some people that are doing that. Joe Reddish has been reading this same literature, and his son is a neuroscientist, so I spent some years studying neuroscience as well, as I said, and that has gone into, and I say some of that in my paper. There's toward a modeling theory of physics instruction. That was kind of a heavy paper in 1987. That was published. It was actually written at the same time as the mechanics diagnostic, but it was delayed publication for 2 years because the referee objected. In fact, he objected so strongly he didn't think it was worth the paper that it would be published on. And ultimately, the editor of the AJP overrode his objection and published it anyway, but it delayed it for 2 years. As a consequence of that. And then along with that, we published the result of Haloon's trial. And of course, Haloon is busy doing his own thing, very, very active. It looks like he's promoting physics education in the Arab world. He's working with Saudi Arabia and people in those
regions, countries.
In those countries, yes. Yeah.
Okay, it has already been like 1 hour and 50 minutes, and I very much thank you for spending this much of time with us, and I'm sure I'm delighted, and this has been the most wonderful conversation I have ever had in my entire life, and I thank you for that, and I hope the readers and the listeners of this conversation will also enjoy it, and I thank you very much again. And I hope to read much of your work again in the future with your colleagues and students.
Well, I must say, that the main reason that you led me on is by saying that you've actually read these things.
I did, honestly.
And so it's a pleasure to talk to somebody that you know is taking you seriously.
For the last 15 years, I have been following your work very closely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
And again, thank you for your all the contributions in physics and physics education, and also giving this conversation.
Okay,
thank
good.
You.